cinephiles, audiophiles, ladies and germs, welcome to the Film Cult Podcast. Tonight, Willie Lee McIntyre Jr., but you're all going to better know him as Sketch 185. Willie, how are you this evening?
Hey, how you doing? I'm doing very well. Doing very well. You know, rested. Today's a day off. Got to work on music. Feeling, you know, just had dinner. Feeling pretty good. You know, excited to be here.
This album, He Left Nothing for the Swim Back. I kind of knew you before this from like Tomorrow Kings.
Oh, really?
I wasn't fucking expecting this album at all. And a buddy of mine handed it to me and he's like, I know you're going to love this. And I put it on and I listened to it 17 times back to back to back.
Oh,
that's
wow.
How fucking good I thought it was. And I'm like, first off, I need him on the show. And if somebody doesn't know and hasn't heard this album, everybody needs to hear this album because it's fucking fantastic. You are right now playing with some like early 90s KRS-One shit, in my opinion.
Oh, and thank you.
It fucking blew me away. Where was the original inspiration for this album?
Oh, it's funny. Like, me and Jeff Markey, you know, the sole producer on the record, like the other half of the record, we've been friends for a long time. Like, I met him, I'd say 13 years ago or so. We've done a little bit of music since then, but over the years of us, well, we remixes, one-offs, so on and so forth. But over the years, it's kind of become a conversation between them. And around the time COVID happened, I already had like 2-3 dozen beats by him. But we kind of sat down and I heard something that I liked. And our conversations as friends and where we were going in life kind of merged at the same time. I was finally mentally ready to work. And more or less, like, I had a health scare, in which case I really started to think about mortality. As we're starting to put together a record, I was thinking about names of the album, so on and so forth. It had a lot of names. On the first track, the initial name of the album or group was Royal Ski Mask. You can hear it on the first song. I say it at the end of the ad-libs. But, like, at one point, being worried about, you know, being terminally ill, which luckily I wasn't, really made me reflect on one of my favorite movies, Gattaca. And the scene in the end in which the main character does his childhood race in the water with his brother. And he explains that he never leaves enough energy to go back home. And it just reminded me of, if this is the last thing we do, we need to get all of these things said. And, like, the album kind of shaped itself from there. You know, it's, you know, certain subjects on the record, I just have actively chose not to talk about throughout life. Like, throughout putting out music. That at that moment, I was like, if I'm gonna leave nothing for the swim back, I gotta say it.
Well, and there's not even like there's not a word out of place on this album. You and Jeff have made pretty damn near what a perfect record should be and frankly is. Like it's fucking fantastic. So I guess when you went in with that mentality, did you find it, I guess, easier to throw lyrics down for this album, or was it maybe a little bit harder?
Like, the funny thing is, with a lot of it, even though that was the theme, I write a lot without beats. You know, like, so our record was a back and forth between things that I had written, just over a 4-4 metronome in my head. Or a stolen beat here and there in our conversation. So there are moments in which, like, I knew that there was a subject that I had. Jeff would play me something, and all of a sudden I'd go, okay, I got something for it. But then, like, you know, I was also in a couple situations romantically, things like that, and still reeling with certain things. So one thing that would happen often is that I would write a song, or have lyrics written, he would send me the beat. I'd record at home, send it to him. We, between where he lives and where I live, because they live in the same neighborhood, is a basketball court. There's a lot in between, but one of our meeting points is a basketball court. We would discuss the record as it was developing, lyrics and the beats as it was developing, while shooting around a basketball over the course of a year, over the course of like pandemic, over the course of a year. So like the songs were like some of the lyrics, you know, even if I had something written like 2-3 years before where it fit, I would have to rewrite them, and he'd change the beat and I'd have to rewrite it, to redeliver it. So it was a lot of back and forth shaping some of the songs, you know, like, you know, you have songs like J Street where by the time we got to where it is, there were like 2 or 3 different versions of the beat. There was different arrangements on it. It was really like the lyrics and the beats worked the way it was because it legit was a year and a half conversation, like multiple times a week, and text and emails and me me texting them lyrics and he'd go, okay, cool, record it. Them sending me something going, let's this, and just all that back and forth. Like, it's the most involved record I've done in regards to a producer-rapper relationship, to be honest.
Well, I was also wondering, do you think that you ever could have recorded this album when you were living in Chicago? Or did it maybe take moving to New York and being there for as long as you have now to really get this out of you?
Yeah, I could not have done this album in Chicago. Like it's not any diss to my hometown. It's just there are certain things. There are just certain elements to the record that didn't exist in Chicago for me to talk about. Barely Draw a Hero. Oh, my radiator's breathing me the thoughts of leaving the salt of earth for the birds of chemtrails. It's like me literally, it's a couple things. It's also a nod to a Superfly Crime record. Wolves doesn't even know that. One of his lyrics. And it's also like, there's elements to survival in New York as an average citizen. Isn't similar, but not quite the same. Chicago, that like string itself through the entire record. And me as a person, like when I moved here, I was in a soon-to-be 5-year relationship that ended, but was a relationship. And a lot of this record was on the hills, me dealing with that, but me learning how to be single, me learning, me approaching where I was as an adult man and how my worldview on survival, excuse me for saying that so much, but my worldview on survival, a city I'm not familiar with, no family, was like. So there's a certain level of stress. There's without a doubt a certain level of comfort I have in Chicago that I didn't have in New York. So there's just a certain way I couldn't write in terms of subject matter. That, there's no Chicago version of this album that could have been done.
Do you find that you're like keeping up with the new artists, like especially in New York? Or are you going out to local shows? Or are you trying to keep up on the scene right now?
Like I do what I can. I bartend for a living, and I bartend 5 nights. So there are certain shows I can't be at, but whenever possible, I'm out. And I feel fortunate that there are younger producers and MCs that reach out, or I will meet, that not only do we connect with music, but I get to see their enthusiasm about the scene and explore the world through them in time. So that leads me to things that I can't see. Just, there are certain things you just won't discover being at home. There are just certain conversations you won't hear when you're at home. So when I get out, I'll see guys. And there's a lot of really cool MCs out here. There's a lot of good music out here. So whenever I can, I'll go to shows. Because there's no point of doing this if you don't. There's no point of putting out rap music if you don't want to be involved in rap. So I definitely get out there, and there are guys like, you know, I know you didn't ask for names, but like guys like Shamar, one group, No Label, Big Flowers, who just moved in. Man, and it's tough because I don't want to like leave anybody out, but they're you know, well known dudes like Mike and, you know, and guys like that of his squad, and they're just, you know, like, there's really cool stuff going on, you know, and I try to keep up when I can, you know.
Well, and your voice has such like a bombastic, smooth cadence to it. Like it's something actually really special. And I'm curious, what did you grow up on musically? Because it almost has like a little bit of like some like early 80s like hardcore to it, but then it also has some like really cool like 50s jazz that you can hear some influence in there. Were you even growing up on stuff like that, or is that just like surroundings and you don't even know that you're picking that up?
In that respect, like that would be a back and forth. Like I didn't grow up on hardcore, but most of my influences are rap. I didn't realize how big they were on jazz. Then as I started to get into college and the years after, started to inform myself more about jazz, or like all the young rebels like bebop and free jazz and so on and so forth, which kind of, you know, as I started, you know, listening and studying rappers that I like a Mystical or Freestyle Fellowship or Sister or Logic and Paramount or, you know, Common, or, and you start realizing that they take cues from jazz instruments to like develop their flow. Like, you know, he's a troublesome guy, but if you listen to Mystical, who was a big influence, the way he raps sounds like a trumpet. That was a big influence on me. Or the fact that like you'll get somebody like Logical, well, who, or Aesop, or even Pharoah, when you listen to him, and the way they go about it is like listening to Sonny Rollins or Coltrane in terms of syllable placement in order to make the percussive a sound, you know, of the syllables. And that was always a big thing to me because I thought it was fun. Sticky Fingers is probably one of my bigger influences growing up from Onyx, because he had a scratchy voice. KRS-One was a great one because, like, just the idea. And later Chuck D would have been around college, you know, Company Flow and such. But in terms of like voice, KRS-One, I Got Next was a record where hearing it, hearing the way he just cut through everything, was informed me properly when I was young, and like learning, you know, because a lot of my technique early on came from rapping on the street, came from street ciphers, came from street battles. So it came from not having a microphone. And at that time, I'm 5'7" now, but at that time I'd have been like 5'4", 5'3", 5'4". And, you know, surrounded by obviously taller people with stronger voices. And like, I just learned how to create that boom, to be able to cut through everybody for them to hear me. And it just, I never let that go. Because I know that's one thing that like, as you record more, you do try to get more nuance in the voice, but I never wanted to let go of the boom, especially given how many MCs don't approach it that way anymore. I still appreciate like that boom and that cutting through, as an orator.
Well, I want to go back to something that you said a little earlier about how you didn't leave anything off the table on this one. Do you actually find it maybe a little bit harder now writing post this record, or has it actually been maybe even a little bit easier post this record because you let it all go? Maybe it's even a little bit more free at this point.
It's honestly been a little harder, and like it's the combination. Don't get me wrong, I enjoy the challenge. Just the combination of my previous album, Gunship Diplomacy, this album, and me more so, more than anything, trying to figure out where I want to go as an MC. And me you know, seeing like my heroes still progress style-wise and do things that excite them and they didn't do on previous records, and me trying to figure out my version of the same thing. It's like, okay, you know, I'm not touching the same subject anymore. I touch those. What in my life do I want to talk about that I haven't spoken about yet? What subjects in the world do I want to talk about? Plus, once I get all those, how do I do things that I find fun, that I find interesting? How do I challenge, entertain myself in a certain way where it doesn't feel like I'm retreading something 10 years ago or 2 years ago or 6 years ago, something that I did on a guest appearance? So it's more difficult, but I welcome the difficulty. Because whatever comes out on the other side is going to be hopefully different than the last record. And even as me and Jeff work on the next record, structure-wise, I'm enjoying it being difficult. Like, it's necessary for it to be difficult because it's necessary for me to be a different person or to be an evolved, more evolved artist.
I like that you've mentioned this because, and I kind of want your take on this. Do you feel like not enough artists are making art for themselves these days?
Yeah, I can see that. Like, because it's a tough part because, like, the commerce is so skewed now. You know, because people are putting out 2, 3, 4, 5 albums back to back to back. And for some people, that's the way they work. And for some people, they just have to do it because you have to stay in the market. You have to stay in the consciousness until you're at a certain point of visibility. And because until you're at a certain point of visibility, you cannot step back if you want to achieve things at a certain pace. Because you never know when you're going to strike later and when your progress is going to accelerate based on interest. The only problem with that is you could find yourself writing the same song 5 times over 5 different beats. And, it's hard, it's hard and it's wrong for me to speak for other artists, but I can kind of get a sense of when people are phoning it in, but they're phoning in the subject, but they're doing it with passion. So their earnestness, masks the fact that they just haven't had time to really mull over what they want to do and do the spin that made them excited in the first place as a market demand. I'm probably going to get a text from a friend of mine when this comes out saying that I don't know what I'm talking about. But I believe that's the case. Because, it's kind of hard to pour your heart out and, like, take your brain to the edges of itself 3, 4, 5 times a year, but twice a year, or 4 times a year, 2 times a year, and do 20, 30 guest appearances and so on and so forth. And like, it's almost impossible to do that, but you have to do that because of the nature of it. So yeah, I agree. I do agree. Okay, cool. Yeah, like, please let me know if, like, I steered too far off the question.
Oh, hell no. I want you to maybe touch a little bit more on Gattaca, because I fucking love that you're grabbing, like, influences from that.
Without a doubt.
Well, and I'm curious, how much has film played a role in your life growing up, now, through your entire career? Like, how much you're drawing from film-based references as well?
I mean, like, it's funny because, like, I think what started it was that, I had cable as a kid and there was always previews to Gattaca, talking about the making of it, so on and so forth. Finally saw the movie and I was blown away by it. And it's one of my favorite movies, one of my top 3 favorite movies. And, throughout life, the main character, like, that always stuck with me. There was something about the idea of being told you can't do this And the reason why you can't do it is because you're not supposed to be able to. It's not because you didn't try hard enough. Not it was like based on something that may happen to you, based on your birth, you're not able to do this thing that you work hard for. And everybody's resigning themselves to. Everybody agreed that that's the way it is. And he just kind of went, no, that's not what a dream is. And he went through every step possible to keep people from interrupting his dream. And, you know, even when he came out, I think he might have came out when I was 12. That's a pretty powerful message. And, you know, like, you know, him telling his brother, didn't leave any for the swim back. You know, when I heard that, that just kind of became like the eternal mantra. You know, when I was a teen, I went to a high school downtown Chicago, who that Chance would later go to. But the only reason that school is important is that kids came from all over the city to go there. So you started to develop friends from all over the city. So, and a lot of us, most of us really, were either from dangerous parts of the city or just very ignorant parts of the city. But in order to hang out with your friends, you went to. Some of my classmates would. But for me, I just developed a sense that in order for me to achieve what I wanted to achieve and do what I wanted to do, I couldn't let things get in my way. Or more accurately, I couldn't play by the same rules and restrictions as everybody else. I couldn't get scared of going too far because of how far I got to travel back. Because, you know, if you go to Chase Cafe, you know, which is in Rogers Park, Chicago, which is at the edge of the city on the north side. But where I grew up, if you're a hip-hop head, you might do it. If you were an average kid, you wouldn't do it. And now as an adult, friends of mine travel even less. But in order to see what I saw, hear what I hear, be involved in what I had to be involved in, I had to be willing to put out energy that other people weren't able to. Weren't willing to. And because of that, I developed a friend group with people who did the exact same thing. And a lot of them, 20 years later, I'm still friends with. So, like, in that respect, that movie really did do a lot for me in regards to seeing somebody not let obstacles get in the way. And, you know, in the end, it was kind of found out. Well, one of the guys that he dealt with every day knew that he was an apostle. But he let him go because he saw what he could do. And, you know, things like that are important because for me, a lot of times, there were people who saw wasn't skilled, but saw the potential, saw the effort, saw that look in my eyes, and they gave me a chance and I showed up. And, you know, that movie right there really, you know, so, you know, thank you for that question. That has always been a thing for me. You know, in terms of movie references, they do show up throughout my work from time to time. Just I'll throw in something in a line here and there or a reference to a Spike Lee film or something like that. Because, you know, it's the entertainment style of choice for me. Like I have two of my best friends. One is in Hollywood. The other one went to school for film. So one of the ways we communicated was watching movies. And when you're young, like, you know, growing up, I grew up, it really wasn't shit for teenagers. So one of the things you could do without being bothered was go to the theater. Film was, you know, if I had no friends that wanted to hang out, I could go see a movie. Me and my friends had nothing else we could do, we could go see a movie. And, like, it was, you know, that became the way in which, like, I framed things. Like, throughout my work, you'll occasionally hear me, and I went to school for art, I'll make references to, like, framing or pan out, you see this, zoom, and so on and so forth. Because, you know, like, we understand that language. And even if you don't get it immediately, the context clues lead you to thinking about film. you know, I think it's a powerful way to display, to illustrate a metaphor. Yeah.
How much do you think that art school also helped expand your mind? Do you feel like you were like really like flowering at that time?
Oh, it changed everything. You know, like, why even get into the art part of it? One of the tough things about everything is, so I grew up in Chicago for a brief moment, lived in California, in which case that was the first time I ever didn't live in an all-Black neighborhood. And at the age I was in, it taught me a lot about diversity. But it taught me that there are just different ways of living and being happy and approaching art and so on and so forth. Don't know about. Come back, when all Black neighbors, that's a beautiful thing. I ain't where I'm going with it. But once I get to high school, I'll see another version of that. Once I get to college, see such a different version, because this is something, and I went to art school, which meant you, especially the school I went to, you didn't necessarily go to that school to figure out what you wanted to be as a kid. I mean, as an adult. It wasn't like going to a university. You went to the school because you wanted to do something with visual art. You wanted to be a stepping stone. It was the first time in my life I was around people who, at least at that moment, knew that's what they wanted to do. So you see a certain type of focus. And we all have the same homework assignments. We all have, and you're around people who are relentlessly creative. So sometimes they're fighting the fact that fraternity asks for them to, you know, have a normal job or look for stability. Some say fuck it, some can afford not to, so forth. And you get all of that there where everybody's coming from different walks of life. So I'm getting the art, I'm getting the history lessons, I'm getting people's personal experience, personal music taste. I'm learning, you know, certain things. I'm developing concepts of identity. You know, I'm starting to learn about art from going to parties that I would have never learned about before and all of that. Like, it, you know, I don't still live in college mentally, but it molded me in such a way that it prepared me for the randomness of the world. Because it also kind of was an expansion on what I did in high school, where anytime somebody told me about something, I'd say yes. So I went to college in my hometown. And it was like, if I don't go see things in my hometown in a new way, it's just me in high school. So, like, just the arts, the history, the experiences of art school inform all of my music.
Well, and you paint such a beautiful picture with your lyrics. Do you think that your education in the visual medium kind of, I guess, honed in on that as well and really helped to shape what would come there as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, without a doubt. They're, you know, like, and they're just every once in a while, little cheap things that I do and I enjoy it. Like, I will write and do something to make it, to give you the idea that it's a light source or, like, describe color. You know, in a lyric, just to create the tone and go, like, in order to walk through the scene, you gotta kind of understand that it's green, or like there's an amber light or things like that. Like, being, like, you know, we having to do art reports or describe our own pieces. You know, you start to learn how to break down painters' approach into a relatable way. And, like, that is without a doubt how I handle some of my lyrics. Like, some things I do treat like I'm describing a painting to a person. You know, like it's, you know, J Street is kind of one of those. Like, it's, and, like, the way the whole verse is about me using word association to get a woman to remember who I am. But if you zoom out on it, it also reads like trying to describe a Hieronymus Bosch painting. Because it's all of these absurd things right next to each other that if you separate them, it looks absurd. When you put it together, it's the dude that you were talking to on the phone today. Yeah, so absolutely. Like, art school definitely informs the way I write.
This was, you mix this at the greenhouse, right?
Oh, no, actually, no. It was mastered at the greenhouse. It was mixed, but still tipped up.
Okay. Okay, so did you always have that in mind? When you were, like, I guess, even halfway through, like, the concept of this, did you know that that's kind of where you wanted to go?
It was a toss-up, because I had worked with Still Tipped Up before. And, you know, we talked to Green, we talked to Dove, and Dove's passionate about it. And the approach, me and Jeff were both just like, yeah, that's how we're going to go. Like, we knew that Green was going to be involved in the project this summer. Because Green had mastered my previous project, had mastered Jeff's project, had mixed things with Jeff. You know, like, I've been on a bunch of Backwoods releases, so stuff like that. I've done songs with Green. But, like, Dove just made sense for how we were doing it, like, how we were shaping the project. You know, because a lot, you know, because based on him going, yo, we're going to do it until it gets done, to the way y'all like it. Just his whole conversation about it. There are like 4 or 5 different versions of almost every song on the record. And it was a certain level of experimentation that I had that I hadn't had since me and A.M. Breakup was working on our previous record. Where I was like, this feels good. This feels comfortable. And having Jeff in the studio and all of us sitting there, I was like, this is the environment. And we knew that like in the first session. Because, you know, after session one, you can always go to somebody else. But in the first session, we were just like, yeah, this feels right. You know, and I think it was when we started like getting into He Left Nothing for the Swim Back, the particular song, and we were going through all the layers. We found this static buzz that sounded like a guitar. This is me describing it. Jeff's going to get mad. But it sounds like a guitar plugging into an amp. We were like, what if we use that to start it? Jeff said, no, do this, this, and this. And we did it, and we all sat there and went, yeah. Like, this is the right guy for this. And his production on his own. Not just his production for rappers. He puts out a lot of instrumental records. They're fantastic. And knowing, like, his attention to sound design, his attention to detail, and what he does on tracks that aren't meant for rappers, really stuck with me. So it all kind of like came together the way we wanted it to. Perhaps Green would be next, but like definitely know I want Green for master. Because Green is the man.
Well, can we expect you to like even evolve this a little bit further in like a more comprehensive tour? Is there any plans for anything the rest of this year?
You know, right now, I'm working, me and Jeff are working on our next record. My group Tomorrow Kings, we're getting our final mixes back on our next record. You know, so hopefully there will be a tour. So hopefully there will be a tour this year. I believe so. You know, it's just either going to be after the next record's released or close to it being released. So, because I went out on the road last year with Shrapnel, and that was awesome. But I definitely want to get back on the road. Being on stage is one of my favorite things to do. And, like, last time was incredible. And, you know, I just, you know, it felt good to be in unfamiliar places and have the opportunity and blessing of people actually knowing my music. In the previous tours, that might happen once or twice. But the idea that, like, reaching people gives me the drive to like do more, figure out how to evolve my show. So, and you know, I just wanted a chance to, you know, do something more interesting for people. Do something more interesting for myself.
What can we expect from this new album?
a lot of social commentary. It's gonna be a little more ornate in terms of the rhyming, because you know it's gonna be a little more dizzying, which I'm happy for. A lot more appearances from my crew, Tomorrow Kings. Jeff's doing incredible shit right now, to be honest, and he's always hitting me with a lot. So like the beats are gonna be cool. There's a high chance that they're gonna be a little more heavy hitting than the previous record. You know, it's like, you know, a little more bombast, great sound design. We touched on a few subjects, speaking about a few things that I hadn't spoke about, you know, internally and externally. You know, just approach the subjects that I left at the moment.
You mentioning social commentary, I have to ask, and I feel like I have to ask this of all my guests recently, because yeah, it's the world that we fucking live in. But are you terrified? And I guess are you hopeful for the future? Because I feel like I always have to add that in, because I am curious. I like, especially artists, are you hopeful for the future? But I guess really the base point here is, are you fucking terrified?
Here's the tough part. Like, to be terrified meant there was a time in which I was comfortable. Or at least for me, at peace. Because I've had people go, man, times are scary. I was like, well, shit, I had guns to my head at least twice, if not more, between the ages of 12 years old and 22. And that's guns to my head. That's not every time I got stopped or harassed by cops. Like, well, once was a gang member, once was a set of cops. Had a dude I knew who was in the Aryan Brotherhood, who used to be in the Aryan Brotherhood. Wasn't when we talked. He told me to be prepared because the other side was prepared for a race war. I was 24 when that conversation happened. 24, 25, 39. I have like socially left friends who keep me informed about a little bit of everything, from like right wing politicians discussed oil spills. I know the world's on fire. I don't know exactly how to be terrified. Like, I know how to be happy in a burning field. That's kind of always been the case. You know, the world's been on fire, and I'm still worried about my next date night. You know, it's tough because, like, what I would try to be optimistic, but it's kind of hard because people will kill just to have normalcy. People will also bend the knee to have normalcy, and it doesn't matter if the normalcy is torture, as long as they can predict everything. And like that's, you know, that's what I'm worried about now. So I can't say I'm terrified. I just can't say I'm surprised. I wish there was a better way of putting it.
And that's fair. Do you, I guess, New York is kind of an epicenter for change. Oh, it has been in the past. I can't really say that now, but it has been in the past. Do you see that right now? Do you see the youth trying to change things in where you're at specifically?
Honestly, I don't. That's the thing. I don't know, because admitted, what did kind of delight me was not in New York, but in Chicago, when the black youth were downtown. Like if you're black growing up, almost. If you're on the south side, maybe on the west side, I can speak on the south side. Downtown was this weird, magical place that, like, your parents went to pay bills. People who, quote unquote, had their shit together might have worked down there. And where white people roamed free and bought shit you couldn't pick up. It wasn't a scary place. But it was a badge of honor unless you live near there to go there. That's not a badge of honor. But it was a bragging point. Like, oh, where'd you get those? Me and my mom went downtown, Marshall Fields, and bought this. Or I went to the North Face store downtown. Or I went downtown. So it became a place that, like, was not off limits, but out of the imagination of kids. And in the summer of 2020, where the black youth couldn't take it anymore, which was completely understandable, to start fucking things up down there. That was when I went, okay, that invisible wall that was maintained by all sides was no longer there. And people who didn't want to take it can't take it. Didn't take it. You know, admitted some of them did it for entertainment. All of them did it out of frustration. It was a city founded by a black man. Can't say that I see the same in New York, but it also might be because I see the progression, but we know that marching the way we think about it doesn't work. People unionize but aren't showing any repercussions to them getting fired out of the union. So, you see things like that in New York and elsewhere, but like, I'm not seeing repercussions to not out for progress the way I wish I did. It might just be that, like, I'm not looking close enough. Because I know artistically, there's a lot of rebellion. You know, there's a lot of synthesis. There's a lot of crazy shit going on. Sociopolitically, I don't see the fear of youthful progression, youthful aggression, youthful progression, or don't understand how these kids are doing this. Or why this makes sense to them, in a way that I really wish I could. I just say I hope I'm just missing it. Next time we talk, I have a laundry list of like movements that are making change, that are scaring Eric Adams into like doing something for the people.
Well, you and I kind of grew up in a time where. Correct me if I'm wrong, and if you see it a different way, but I feel like we grew up during artists really, I guess, breaking into the mainstream with their politics and their rebellion. And I kind of don't see that now. Why do you think that is?
If it's younger artists, because of their heroes. When you get guys around my age now, like, you had some rebellious guys. Sure. Guys as in not just men, but as in artists. Rebellious people of all genders, colors, and creeds. But there was a lot of acquiescing. I don't want to call out names, but, I didn't ask your age, and I won't out of, respect. I'm 39. When I was in college is when I saw what was previously considered selling out on a mass scale. And it was proselytized. There were articles on why artists had to do it, especially hip hop, why music should be free. Complete bullshit. It was bullshit back then. Arguing with people about it being bullshit. People arguing with me. Come to find out, I was right, and we all still aren't making money. It's not like that. But it's a whole generation of people that pushed over. Yes. And those people are the heroes of the young artists. So, when the people you look up to don't have that subversive thought or rebellious spirit, that's who you looked up to. My age, I was young enough to see a slightly young Jesse Jackson. All his faults. All the civil rights leaders were still able to dance on the dance floor, still talking, and still remember vividly, bigger, certain, when they were young, but also actively talking about the message of the day. I had multiple generations of socially active people present the way that I'm not sure they have now. It was a different type of, not saying that the people now don't know what they're talking about, so on and so forth. It's just the heroes are different. The stakes are different. What people are willing to lose for integrity is different. You know, and you know, admit it, for a lot of me and my friends, we were a bunch of fucking angry atheists. I thought the world was shit, and you know, we're going right on everything and be political shit and take over things and like do graffiti and like so on and so forth. And you know, it's just the new generation communicates differently. You know, just to be real.
Well, I'm going to end this on a little bit of a brighter note, just because I'm curious, because you're a Chicago guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Chicago pizza or New York pizza?
Ooh, Chicago pizza. But you know, by Chicago pizza, I mean Chicago thin crust. Growing up out south, there are deep dish spots, but there are deep dish pizza makes up a tiny part of the market. The Chicago thin crust pizza is done different in itself. Heavy amount of butter. You don't know where you get it. Cornmeal in the crust. You don't do the little bullseye spiral shit that they do in New York. You cover the dough with sauce. Completely covered. Put the toppings on top of the sauce. Cover it with cheese until you can't see the sauce. Then you bake it. So each piece has the same level of flavor in each bite. You know, it's a bias of my childhood. But, you know, in New York, there's a spot called Ebbets that sells style pizza, tavern style. I didn't know. We never got it from the tavern. Found that name out when I was about to move to New York. But, tavern style pizza is what I grew up with. Still my favorite. No matter where I go in America, it's still my favorite style. You know, big offense to everybody. It's all right. If they're mad, I'm okay with it. I'll still eat your pizza. I'm okay with everybody's pizza. Pizza can coexist. But if given a chance, I will get a beggar's pizza over DeForest. It's not because I don't like DeForest. It's just I like Becker's Pizza more.
Well, I'm actually coming to New York in July, so maybe I'll hit you up and you show me the best spot to go then.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. Definitely. We could definitely do that.
Willie, I want to thank you so much for coming on here. It really means a lot. I hope everybody listens to this album if they haven't already, and I'm so, so excited for this new album. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on here. Seriously, I really appreciate it. Like, you know, you didn't have to do this. I'm really happy that the record picked up with you. Thank you to anybody and everybody who listens to this.
Thank you for listening. This concludes our broadcast day.